for the very best in bluegrass music, plus classic country, Cajun, rockabilly, western swing, and whatever jumps off the shelves at us. Tune in every Tuesday morning at 6:30 for Pacific Pickin' with your host, Arthur Berman.
And I'm Andrea.
The lovely Andrea, who will also provide you with our concert calendar and every bit of news and information you can possibly need. And as if that wasn't enough, there's a warm-up show at 6 featuring a little bit of a wider variety of roots and branches of bluegrass music. So tune in each morning, 6 for the warm-up show, 6:30 for the main show, Pacific Pickin' on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver.
Hello, I'm Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. On Prof Talk today, Professor Scott Hinge from the Faculty of Forestry discusses his research of Pacific salmon. Dr. Hinge leads the Pacific Salmon Ecology and Conservation Laboratory, which is committed to the study of salmon ecology, behavior, and physiology, and to providing management systems with information needed for the conservation and sustainable use of fish resources. He's also the director of the UBC Undergraduate Program in Natural Resources Conservation, the largest and fastest growing applied science program on campus and one of a kind in Canada. Dr. Hinge spoke with guest host Andy Torr recently about his research.
Scott, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure to be here, Andy.
Now, you're a professor in the Faculty of Forestry, Department of Forest Sciences, but the subject of your research are Pacific salmon. So for the non-biologists tuning in, what's the connection between forests and salmon?
I guess the question should be, what isn't the connection? I mean, salmon have an integral role to play in forests. They are largely driven by forest ecosystems. The water that they need to rear in and spawn in comes from forests, and that which they migrate through. And interestingly, they're one of the few ways that nutrients get back up into watersheds. Most nutrients flow out. Gravity takes them out towards the ocean. Salmon adults bring them back in. And so there's this interesting link between spawning migrations and nutrient enhancement of the watersheds that they spawn in. And so there is a tight link between forests and salmon. But of course, I'm in the Faculty of Forestry, but we do a lot more than just study forests, and really it's a bit of a misnomer in our name, because we do focus mostly on sustainability and resource conservation issues at the broadest level, and my work on salmon and fishes is just a small component of what we do in the faculty.
Now, when we talk about Pacific salmon, we're talking about more than just one species of fish. Which doesn't necessarily translate to the supermarket. We get things like sockeye or coho or what have you in the supermarket. Can you explain a little bit how Pacific salmon break down into species?
Sure. There's five species of Pacific salmon and a couple of species of Pacific trout, which are all closely related. All of the Pacific salmon species have the ability, and most do, migrate from freshwater to the ocean and back to freshwater to complete their life cycle. And some of the populations of those Pacific trout do the same thing. So there's a huge diversity in life histories. The typical life history, of course, is for eggs and offspring to be reared in freshwater for a various length of time, but it may be as short as only a few months before they migrate to the ocean. Some species and populations may spend 2 or 3 years in freshwater before going to the ocean. Once they get to the ocean, some species may only spend a year and come back. Others may spend up to 4 years and come back. So this varies among species, among populations, and it's what makes studying them very interesting. It's what makes managing them so difficult.
You might say it's not easy being a Pacific salmon.
No, it's not, because depending on where you are and where you're going, you're encountering a huge range of environmental conditions. If you can just imagine coming from small streams where you have cool temperatures, then rearing into large lakes where there's suites of large predators, then quickly you're flushed down the Fraser watershed, for example, the Fraser River, at high speeds into the ocean, where you're going to again face another onslaught of natural predators. Many may move off into the open ocean and migrate thousands of kilometers out around Alaska and heading towards the Bering Sea before they come back, and then maybe encounter high temperatures on the way back into the in freshwater. So they're amazingly adaptable animals. And that's one of the aspects of our research, is to look at those levels of adaptation among species and populations.
It seems like there are a number of things that we don't know about Pacific salmon, specifically relating to their physiology, their behavior, their migratory patterns. You run the Pacific Salmon Ecology and Conservation Laboratory. What do you and your lab members hope to learn about those?
Well, for the last 10 years, we've been taking a really new path, and it's been different from what most other investigators have been doing. That's that we're taking an individual animal approach, where we're trying to learn as much as we can across a large range of life history for an individual. And we've done this by integrating telemetry, which I'm sure most people will know. It's like when you put a tracking device on an animal and follow them. We've linked that type of technology with hardcore physiology. And in so doing, we're able to get a snapshot of the condition of an individual and then track and relate that to its behavior and to its fate. And so we've made some really remarkable discoveries about what limits their migrations, what limits their survivorship, what controls their behavior. And this all is changing as the climate changes, and that's an overlying component of our research, is looking at how these environmental changes then affect these behavioral physiological linkages.
Suppose when most people think about climate change, they don't think about salmon.
Maybe I do. Maybe most people don't, but certainly that's the focus of what we're doing now. And you know, we all are experiencing climate change. We've witnessed radical changes from year to year in summer temperatures, winter temperatures. We've seen in terms of the Fraser River a gradual warming of nearly 2 degrees. In the peak summer temperatures now over the past 40 years. So it's something that may be imperceptible to us, but certainly the fish are taking note of. We're seeing changes in river flow patterns. And all of the predictions are that those sorts of changes are going to continue into the future. And so we're trying to know, as these things continue to change, how do the animals deal with those continued changes?
We often hear in the local news about extraordinary salmon returns in places like the Adams River, where the salmon are just shoulder to shoulder, while other populations like those in Cultus Lake are on the brink of extinction. In your opinion, are traditional fisheries management models effective when it comes to managing Pacific salmon, or could they be improved?
Well, there's a whole bunch of questions there. And the examples you chose are actually quite interesting, because those two stocks represent almost the continuum of issues that we've seen in one group of Pacific salmon known as late-run sockeye. And they share in common a really unique behavior, and that is that these late-run groups, and there's others besides those two populations, when they migrate out of the open ocean and down the coast, historically they would hold or mill about in the Strait of Georgia for a period of up to 6 weeks. That made them unique around the world. It also made them unique because it allowed fisheries to have easier access at them in the coastal areas. And around 1994, we had a major shift in that behavior, and large segments of that whole run started to come upriver early, and in some cases with almost no holding in any portion of the run. And what we saw, and that wouldn't be a problem, but what happened is those early migrants, when they come into river, are basically dead fish swimming. And when they when we started investigating this phenomenon further, we realized that these fish weren't getting to spawning grounds, and in some years we were seeing 90-95% mortality of those fish after they departed the ocean early. And so that's where a lot of our initial impetus to study the individual level issues came from. The thing with Adams sockeye is, yes, they were and continue to be relatively large, iconic stock of fish. And they still are relatively large, and they still in some years support fisheries. But this late-run issue has really knocked them back significantly, and it's had a major impact on the fishery, in many cases causing the fishery to be held back or not occurring at all in some years because of those low returns. Cultus is a very sad situation because it, too, is suffering from the same behavioral change, but it was always a small stock to begin with. And so when you take a small stock and put these additional stresses on it, then you see a stock that had 5,000 or 10,000 individuals now only coming back with a couple of hundred. And indeed, it is listed as endangered by the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada, and there's a recovery plan trying to sustain the population and prevent it from going extinct. And you know, at this point, it is holding on, but it's at very low numbers.
If the Strait of Georgia, as you mentioned, is sort of a super highway for salmon, particularly sockeye, it must be impossible for fishers to identify whether the fish that they're catching are from a healthy Adams River run or a highly endangered Cultus Lake population.
Andy, you've hit the nail on the head. One of the biggest problems we have in fisheries management and conservation in this part of the world, and that is mixed stocked fisheries. And when the fisheries go out to capture fish, they don't know exactly the stocks they're getting. They have a good idea of the stock complex, and the way the fishery gets managed is by these complexes based on timing. And the timing groups come down the Strait of Georgia towards the Fraser River, for example, at pretty predictable times from one year to the next. However, within each of these timing groups, there could be dozens of stocks, dozens of populations, some of which may be relatively large, some may be relatively small. And it's very hard to just tackle or just capture the very large ones and leave the very small ones alone. That's just not the way the fishery operates in the Strait of Georgia, and for that matter, in some areas closer to the river and in the river. And so it is a difficult thing for managers to address. And so what's happened in the last few years is the management system has gotten much more risk-averse, in such that if there are small and weak stocks co-migrating with these larger ones, they would have to forsake the capture on everyone. And, of course, that upsets people that are involved in catching the fish because they're losing opportunities. But at the same time, it's needed to protect those weak stocks. Unfortunately, because the whole timing has shifted to some of these large groups, they're also migrating now earlier with a completely different run timing groups that they never migrated with before. So that puts another group potentially off the table in terms of capture because you're trying to protect some weak late run stocks when they're coming through with summer runs. So it's being one of the worst jobs in the world would be a fisheries manager in some regards, because you're constantly having to make these decisions that affect people's livelihoods but also affect the sustainability of some of these really small stocks.
I think that's probably the biggest challenge of fisheries, is balancing the environmental sustainability with the economic sustainability.
Absolutely.
Now, you're a key player in the Fishmonomics Project, which UBC reports recently described as, quote, the most ambitious and large-scale ecological genomics study ever launched on a wild species, end quote. How does the study of salmon genes inform efforts to manage and conserve their populations?
Well, we have to go back again to when this whole late-run issue started to become apparent to scientists. We wanted to understand at the individual level what were the physiological explanations for why they were coming in early and dying on river. There's lots of hypotheses. Ours, we believe that there was something going on internally that was a problem. So we developed an approach just to look at some simple assays, like a doctor would take on you if you went in for a stress test. So we'd take some blood samples, we would take some tissue samples, and we would look at things like your stress levels, whether the fish were utilizing energy appropriately. We'd also look at whether they're preparing themselves for the transition from salt to fresh water. So this individual level biopsy approach that we took started to tell us that, yes, there was some indications that things were different in these fish physiologically of those that came in early and died prematurely. So what we wanted to do is take this to the next level. The next level, of course, is to go back to what causes those changes in physiology, and that you have to go and look at genomic responses. And so we are utilizing technology that really was developed to screen for cancer and pathologies in humans and address the situation where we're looking now at up to 30,000 genes to see which ones are turned on or turned off, and hence creating physiological situations for these fish that are related to their behavior and fate. So what we're doing now is we are still tracking them with devices from the open ocean into fresh water and spawning grounds. But at the same time, the tissue samples we're taking, we're now screening for a whole suite of physiological processes. And what we're learning is quite remarkable. These fish are turning on their reproductive development processes farther out in the ocean than we believed. Some are coming back ill, and some are actually predisposed to die. And that's been the most unique finding so far, is that there's a group of fish that are unhealthy, and we can characterize the signal genetically as well as physiologically now. And the hope now is, now that we've screened a group of fish and we are developing these relationships, can we look for the silver bullet? Can we look for those biomarkers that will tell us if the fish has this particular suite of genes turned on or off, that it is in trouble? We hope that that information will not only inform how we're going to conduct science and understand the natural mortality that they may experience as they migrate towards their ultimate death, because they all die after spawning, but also will inform management, because managers need advanced information. That's been one of the biggest issues, is knowing, being able to predict what will happen to these fish as they move closer and closer to fresh water and closer to spawning grounds, because that's the scale at which these management decisions get made. So if we can inform them that this group of fish is going to have problems, you either have to make sure there is no fishery or these fish are dead. We're telling you that now. Even though they're swimming happily down the coast, these fish aren't going to make it. Then other decisions may be made about fisheries. It also may help inform policy changes, because if we can start to show that there's groups of fish each year that are not responding well to environmental changes, and if we can show with our lab experiments that as the climates continue to warm, and they are warming, and we're doing experiments now to look at temperature changes reflective of the future, if these fish show those same physiological signals and they're dying, then this is going to tell us which stocks and which species are going to be the ones most susceptible to perish and why they're perishing in these future climates.
And you're actually conducting this research in collaboration with the Department of Fisheries.
Absolutely. The way things are going these days with funding situations, and there's just no way that academia or government agencies can work alone. So we've been working together for over a decade now, and we share research facilities at two or three places around the province, and it's completely collaborative. The good thing about that is that the information that we find can get fed more directly into the management system, and so that's been benefit to both of our groups.
Should consumers be concerned about the sustainability of wild salmon fisheries in BC?
Well, sure. Absolutely they should be concerned about it. But it's a very complex issue. Researchers are still debating, what are the issues in terms of stock-specific sustainability. Managing for stocks is pretty much impossible in many regards. Managing for run-timing groups is more possible. Managing at the species level is somewhat more easy. Yet, we're not eating the species. We're eating a population in many cases. And those things, we don't know where necessarily fish are always coming from. A lot of fish get sold internationally that are captured locally. Last year, we didn't have any Fraser sockeye, for example, captured because there was no fishery, yet sockeye appeared in our markets from Russia. This all comes back to understanding from a certification perspective whether stocks are being managed and in a sustainable fashion, and also understanding whether we are believing labeling and whether labeling is even occurring.
In recent years, speaking of labeling, there's been a real popularity in these sort of seafood wallet cards, trying to get consumers individually involved in conservation by the choices that they make when they're in the supermarket. Does this consumer behavior actually make a difference in their numbers? Is there any information on that? Or is there something more effective that individuals can do if they're concerned about salmon populations?
Yeah, well, it's hard to know whether it's making a difference at this point. I'm not sure what research has been done to show that it makes a difference. I think it's probably important. The problem we have, however, with a lot of local Pacific salmon stocks is that they have been depressed in recent years. We've had very poor ocean survivorship. We've had relatively low catches in a lot of our local groups of fish. So we haven't had a lot of those fish out there available for sale. Certainly there's been a lot of fish that's been available from elsewhere around the world. Alaska is doing quite well in terms of producing fish. A lot of debate over whether they're producing them sustainably. But nonetheless, there's a lot of fish out there, wild fish. And as you know, aquaculture fish are ample. They're abundant. They are produced year-round. They've generally driven the price of wild fish down in some regards. So it's difficult for the consumer to know in a real simple way what is the best decision to make. Certainly, there are some species that perhaps are better than others that people should be concerned about. Those wallet cards, especially some that I've seen the Vancouver Aquarium produce, are quite useful, I believe. I know they've got a program with a lot of local restaurants to help with labeling and identifying sustainable seafood. I think that's a move in the right direction. Even UBC, I believe, is considering or moving on understanding the use of sustainable seafood products in our restaurants and on site. So I think that's encouraging.
Obviously, there's a lot more work that needs to be done in the area, and sustainable resource management is a hot and popular topic, particularly here in British Columbia. You've been at this for 10 years. You've got a lab and a number of grad students working under you, but you're also director of the Natural Resources Conservation Undergraduate Program. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's quite an amazing program. It's one of a kind in Canada. The Natural Resources Conservation Program is a transdisciplinary program. It involves natural sciences and social sciences with the idea of learning how to conserve and manage natural resources at the broadest level. There's a strong emphasis on field work, field component. There's emphasis on planning, an emphasis on quantitative approaches, on communication skills. It's a fast-growing program. Interestingly, around the world, we see programs in forestry and even environmental science collapsing or stagnating. This program has been growing considerably each year, and I certainly welcome more growth to the program, and it's been a challenge to manage it, but we are growing internationally. We're getting almost 15-20% of our students come from international locales now, and that's growing even faster than our national recruitment. We've tapped into something with this program, and students want it. Our students get jobs when they leave. Or they go on to other educational endeavors. And I mean, it's a microcosm, really, in my view, for what we do in the faculty, because we probably should be called the Faculty of Sustainability and Conservation. Probably will never be able to call ourselves that for various reasons on campus, but that's truly what we do. And this program is one of several that deal with those types of issues. And so I certainly encourage folks to look us up and either come here or send your kids here or learn more about the program, because it's certainly something that our students have gone on and really benefited from.
You've been listening to Professor Scott Hinch from the Faculty of Forestry, Department of Foreign Sciences, on Prof Talk, CITR Campus Radio 101.9. My name is Andy Torr.
This is Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM on the Point Grey campus in Vancouver. If you would like to send us feedback of this show, please email us at proftalk@gmail.com. Or for an updated schedule, visit our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. You can also listen to the podcast of this show anytime on citr.ca. I am Farha Khan. Talk to you next week.
Thank you. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, some weird and way